brought to you by Oklahoma Men's Clinic, the leader in men's health and sexual wellness.
It was just my nonconformist approach. So I don't mind that it's unique, but there's actually an objective reason as to why it occurred. When I was in training in critical care in the ICU medicine world, some European research came out that they had done some really cool studies in the ICU, and people wearing neckties that drape down to the waist, as they would do exams of patients, different things of that nature, if the necktie dragged across, say, the bed or the patient or so forth, it would pick up bacteria. And if it was picking up resistant bacteria, and you could take that from room to room, you're washing your hands, right, you're doing everything else right. And so local spread in an ICU could be related to neckties. And so...
So you went bow tie as opposed to going no tie?
So I went bow tie. I was in an environment when I was in residency and fellowship where if you were not in scrubs, coat and tie was expected.
Right.
And when you are in an environment where coat and tie are expected, that was the switch.
You're from Oklahoma. You could have gone bolo.
Yeah, I could have gone bolo.
You could have been Bob Macy, the Bob Macy of the ER.
Yeah. Yeah, you were never going to catch me in a bolo. And the challenge with that is when I went to medical school in San Antonio, the professor for psychiatry that everyone hated was a bolo wearer.
Oh, yeah.
So you had this negative attachment to that, and all sorts of nicknames for that guy that I couldn't even share here on the radio.
Okay, so a couple of things. I mean, I keep thinking eventually we're going to get away from having to talk about COVID, and yet it just keeps rearing its ugly head.
Right, right.
So the celebrities, athletes, TV talk show hosts, et cetera, that keep testing positive and having to quarantine or go away for a while or take a few days off. I have a theory on that, and I'm curious to your thought about the practicality of this. My theory is that we've been, or a good portion of the population has been vaccinated to the point that they are getting either asymptomatic or very minimally symptomatic COVID, but they're testing positive because they're in a protocol where they're being tested so often.
Yep. Yep.
At which point the question begs, when does it become more of a burden to test than not test? Now, I realize we have people that are not vaccinated and you want to try and protect those people, even though some of that is because of their own refusal to take the vaccine. But we want to try and protect those people as much as we can. But at some point, doesn't it become a burden, the idea of testing and getting either a false positive or getting a true positive, but it's asymptomatic? And if you're in an environment where people are vaccinated and you're doing everything else right, are you really achieving anything by doing what they're doing?
So
there's a question in there somewhere.
There is, yeah. I'm kind of where you are, which is we've moved past, as we get to this phase, even though we're seeing activity with these Omicron subvariants, we've really moved past this concept for me of a lot of asymptomatic testing, because we've gotten to what I call the law of diminishing returns. What it's doing is creating a lot of this disruption. There's still asymptomatic spread, and there's plenty of people who have been infected with the virus who are not symptomatic, either because they're immune, so forth. So it does mean that if you don't do that, you may miss some of the vectors that can then spread to others. But I've really moved in my mind, and I'm not necessarily sharing party line with a lot of organizations. I've really moved in my mind where I'm more of a proponent right now of just doing symptomatic testing to understand, is it that or not? These asymptomatic protocols are really trying to suppress any spread. And I think we're beyond that, especially with these new variants. You can test all you want. I think you're going to really be challenged. The other reason why I am moving away is because we now have the outpatient treatments. We still have monoclonal antibody. There are things we can do to intervene. And with vaccine availability and booster availability, which repeatedly shows if you stay on schedule, the prevention of hospitalization and death is just unbelievable. So again, a huge vaccine success story. So once you have all those things available, we don't have to go back to day one where it was test, right. quarantine, isolate, because that's all you had. And now we have other things, and so we can take a different strategy. So I don't know that I answered whatever the question that was in there, but my personal bias now is I've moved away from that. And so all that's doing is creating noise. The percent positive rate for testing, I can't use. It's not right. useful to me right. at all.
Well,
in fact, right
people...
now, case counts are hardly useful to me right now. It's really what I need to understand is hospitalization. Now, for doctors on the front line, what's useful to them is somebody who's got characteristic symptoms with a positive test
right.
that caught it early, and they can decide, are you high enough risk that we need to treat you or not?
What's interesting to me about it is that there are plenty of people that aren't in the world that are trying to live in this bubble of this COVID mm-hmm. protection bubble mm-hmm. that aren't being tested that are doing exactly what we're talking mm-hmm. about. It's just that if you go in and have to be tested, there's a chance you're going to get a positive test. What's funny about this, I was going to bring this up. Remember when President Trump made that comment about the less we test, the less the rates are going to be, and was rightfully ridiculed over that, by
yeah,
the way,
at the time. Yeah, absolutely.
But that's where we are now. Post-vaccine, we are in a place now where that actually makes sense, because we are seeing numbers that really are higher and not reflective of the reality, because people are going to potentially test positive, but if they're vaccinated and if they don't get sick, particularly if they're asymptomatic, again, there are people that we need to protect that are unvaccinated and can't be vaccinated. But at the same time, we're almost doing ourselves a disservice. And it scares me that I continue to read these stories about, you know, it seems like every time there is a subvariant, or in this instance, a subvariant of a subvariant,
mm-hmm.
you read these nightmare pieces of, oh, this is the one, this is where we go back down the hill. And there's a chance that we could, but we're so fearful right now that it's hard for us to get out of that shell of. And then I want to go into monkeypox too, because I feel like that's sort of the same thing, which, by the way, it's a lot more fun to talk about monkeypox than it is about COVID or SARS-CoV-2.
Well, I tell you what,
the name
monkeypox is you'd almost thought that was made up until you realize no, that's not actually the the made up name. So you bring up a really good point when it comes to all these subvariants. Listen, they're really, really contagious. Lots of people are still going to get infected, but we also have moved away from what our focus area is, right? Our focus area is not stopping any and all transmission. We certainly want to continue to mitigate that. The focus area around all of this is prevention of severe illness, hospitalization, right. and death. So your strategies adjust, because that's what you're really after. And when something's going to become endemic, as we've talked about before, now your strategies start to look a lot more like what things people are familiar with look like influenza,
but
right?
But see, that's
like
funny
cold
too,
and so forth.
Because that argument from the beginning of, well, this is just the flu, or this is just whatever, and it's something that we're going to have to deal with, and we can't stop
you're
the world.
Right.
We are at a place
you're
now
right.
where that's reality.
That really
2 years ago, we couldn't do that, or we shouldn't have done that. It would have been unethical to do that, but now we're at a place where that is realistic.
Yeah, I was part of a panel where we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago that the chamber put on. It was really, really well done. And we were talking about that very thing. You know, the strategy changes as the situation changes and as the science evolves. And we struggled, right, to help people understand that these changing recommendations are not evidence that people don't know what they're doing. They're evidence that we are increasingly learning what to do
right.
and how to do it.
Right.
And unfortunately, the communication was so poor and things got so polarized and all of that, you couldn't help people understand this is the journey, right? So for those of us in healthcare, we've looked at other illnesses or novel things in our past and we're like, okay, this is the right. journey. And with each thing we learn, let's do this. We debate it. We wrestle with it. We keep challenging ideas. So yeah, 2 years in, the strategy is a bit different. We didn't know back then, is this something we could fully eradicate, or is this something that will turn right. into other coronaviruses? It's looking like, okay, it's turning into other coronaviruses. But the disease has also
changed. The disease has changed downward.
Considerably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or just shouldn't say downward, but it's evolved into a place where it's more manageable from a healthcare point of view, and more manageable from a personal point of view without significant risk factors.
Yeah, and the other thing you have is just public, the public response, right? I mean, after a couple of years of what we've been through, the public response is really been one now of, okay, whatever,
right?
Right? I'm going to take my chances, you take your chances, and here's my personal health strategy, here's my personal right. vaccine strategy, here's yours, and you see that out in the world. So public health people have to adjust to the actual psyche of a population to figure out how to continue to be successful with that being the case.
So that being the case, this monkeypox thing.
Yeah.
Again, there are Chicken Little people writing stories about how here it comes.
I just am not sure this would be the story that it is if it hadn't been for COVID.
And if it wasn't called monkeypox. Here's the thing.
That's right.
I think that we were caught so flat-footed with COVID that we're fearful of everything now. And this thing, listen, don't get me wrong.
That's a good point.
I think if you get this, it's not something to fool around with. But I think being fearful of it from 1,000 feet away or 1,000 miles away is not what COVID was. It wasn't something that was on this steady march like the army of orcs and Lord of the Rings. Yeah. It's something that is out there and it's going on, and in certain conditions, it's something to be afraid of, but it's also treatable. It's also not nearly as infectious, but it's not nearly as communicable.
It's not nearly as COVID. Contagious.
You got to have, like, you got to share spit or be spit on or share a unwashed utensil or have sexual relations with somebody to get it.
It's very close contact. Yeah, see,
and it's a pox. So what I understand, and this is what I think you could weigh in on, is because it's a pox, with smallpox vaccinations, not everybody, I think, has it. Did we get rid of having smallpox vaccinations, or is that still a regular part of
It's not a regular part, but there are stockpiles of that in case something like this would
occur. But those of us that had smallpox vaccinations should have...
You may have immunity this, what we call an orthopox viridae group. And there are vaccinations for... You know, you have the smallpox, and then there is actually an approval process underway for the very specific orthopox grouping that the monkeypox virus is a part of. But let me share some differences here. So this is not novel or new. We've known about this monkeypox virus for over half a century. Right.
Oh, wow.
First came up in like the 50s and 60s in Africa. We've also known what the animal vector is, even though it's called monkeypox. It's probably more rodents that carry it around, although
rodent
it can
pox
be.
Doesn't have the same
it
cachet.
Does, it doesn't, right? Rat pox, I mean, you know, monkey
Whoever
pox is more.
Whoever that chose the right one.
Yeah, so it can be found in certain monkeys, particularly in West Africa. There are a couple of variants. The one that's spreading right now is the West African variant, but it's very different than a respiratory disease where you can get either droplet or now we have aerosolization to where you can get infected. So you get lots of people can get infected from the same person. And monkeypox is not that way. It requires very close contact. Historically, outbreaks would be connected to people who had contact with the animals that were infected. And the name for that in science is called a zoonotic infection, like the zoo, because you got it from an animal. Well, now we're seeing that with the right close human contact of somebody infected and contagious, it can have human to human. We are animals.
Right.
So zoonotic spread from one animal to another. So with that, we're finding that that's occurring, but it's occurring now, and it's occurring because some human behavior has changed, and there are certain groups of people that are more at risk in that regard.
I was reading last night that they're fearful in Europe specifically of this becoming like a sexually transmitted disease.
The European outbreak right now is following sexually transmitted outbreak type situation, and right. this is particularly in the gay male community.
Well, they were saying also the rave culture, which may overlap.
It did overlap, and so what they're trying to do is for the U.S. case that was confirmed, and then those that are being suspected, you know, they've come in from other places, but they're trying to trace that back. Did any of that go all the way back to Europe or not? But there are a few cases that have kind of come out of nowhere, and that's got people kind of scratching their head. Usually what we find is when you get the rest of the story from the people that you find that, no, it's not out of nowhere.
Right.
We can trace that back. So typically this is going to be a situation where somebody has traveled to an endemic area or they have, you know, so we're always asking about recent travel and we're always asking about certain human behaviors and so forth. But the pox are evident in almost everybody. So, you know, somebody ought to be able to isolate. That's typically what we do in this situation is isolate. We don't have an active treatment for it. It's just that
there hasn't been a need for one, right?
No, there hasn't, because people recover. The mortality rate from this condition is about 1%. But there's only so many cases, and that 1% comes out of the data from Africa, where most of these are third world countries, so their medical care isn't as good. So in more modernized society, I don't even know that it would be 1%, and that's absent any treatment. So it's a typical pox. You know, you get the lesions on the skin, some fever, some headaches, some muscle aches, some, you know, back discomfort. They usually are healed up within 2 to 4 weeks and people move on. It's a longer isolation period, though, if somebody has it. But all this noise right now is coming from less than 200 worldwide cases.
Yeah.
So that gives you an idea of how sensitized, how sensitized we are to this type of stuff right now.
Former Navy SEAL Sean Ryan shares real stories from real people from all walks of life on The Sean Ryan Show.
Comedian John Crist.
How long have you been in Nashville?
Let's see, 2018 is when I moved here. I lived in an apartment. I didn't know anything about it. I lived in L.A.
You were living in L.A.? How was that?
Yeah. Well, let's see, good for my career. Send me to rehab, though, so. That's pretty much the sum of it.
The Sean Ryan Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Dr. Kevin Lewis, SSM Health St. Anthony, is with us on Tuesdays. He is here, and we're going to take a couple of questions for you. This is Dwayne. Dwayne, what's your question for Dr. Lewis?
My question is, how come they do not offer the COVID antibody infusions anymore?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, Dwayne, thank you for the question. So, the monoclonal antibody infusion is still available. It is limited, though.
But it's not like a la carte, right?
It's not
like Sonic. You don't pull up and say, I need the number two and an infusion.
You can't. The emergency use authorizations for the different forms of monoclonal antibodies are all very restrictive, and somebody has to be in a high-risk category to receive it. So a physician has to order it and has to certify or specify that, hey, they meet these conditions. Now, the monoclonal antibody that we use has changed because the variants have changed. So different ones are now effective. The one that is being used now, I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, you make fun of me when I make these names, it's bebtomivibab. And the MAB at the end of all of these stands for monoclonal antibody.
Oh, okay.
MAB. That's why they're all MAB at the end. And so it's kind of cool because instead of sitting there for an hour or more, it actually can be, it's IV, but it's an IV push. So within 10 minutes, it's in. So it's shorter process than it used to be and lasts for a while. The reason you're not hearing about it is because infusion centers for somebody with COVID, those pared back down because when you're not in a surge, you can't shift all your staff over to those places. It has to be a completely isolated place because people who are going to be there have COVID, all the garbing up, you know, with the protective equipment, different things. So like there are limitations there. So a lot of places what's happening is if somebody shows up to an ER with COVID and the hospital has supply of the monoclonal, they'll just do the infusion maybe there, try to keep them, see if they can discharge them. There's just different things. So,
but that's also not the only form of treatment.
No, not at all. So that's the other thing. That's exactly where I was going to go next, is because of the success rate of Paxlovid, which is the oral medication that you can take, which has about as good a success rate of keeping somebody out of the hospital as does a monoclonal antibody infusion. You're seeing less of that because if people catch it early. So you're just not hearing as much about it. But a monoclonal antibody treatment is an available treatment for somebody. It is particularly useful for those with kidney disease or liver disease because they can't take some of the oral medication. So it's a really good question. You're just not hearing a lot about it, but monoclonal antibody treatment is still available for those that need it and qualify for it under the way it's authorized.
So we also had a caller who wanted to know about an additional booster for people under the age of 50.
Yeah, so currently the fourth dose booster, if you've been a certain amount of time since your last dose, is approved only above the age of 50, right, under the emergency use authorization. And there are some who argued that 50 was a lower age cut point than was necessary for that. So it, I've heard that somebody who wants another dose can just walk in and get one, but that
regardless of the age.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily following the authorization as performed by the FDA and recommended by the Council for Immunization Practices.
If you knew somebody that was 42,
if I have somebody who's low risk and 42, I do not think it's necessary.
Gotcha.
Yep. I don't think their risk, because again, what we're trying to do here with these boosters is not prevent the potential to even get infected, although it helps that. It's really about hospitalization, severe illness, and death. So somebody in lower age groups, no other risk factors, fully immunized otherwise, especially if they had a third dose, big debate. I would not tell somebody to in that category to rush out and get an additional dose. And remember, the current doses are still, they're based off of the original.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.